Well, Mr. Powell, that did not work out quite the way you wanted it to, did it now? For the first time in a decade, the Fed breaks glass in case of emergency. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, 3 March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The last time we heard from the Federal Reserve about interest rates between official meetings was October of 2008. The collapse of Lehman Brothers was still fresh. The hazards of the financial crisis perhaps just then really becoming clear. And let me be clear here for a second. This is not that. Markets are functioning. There is no credit crisis. There is plenty of liquidity. But there's also plenty of uncertainty about what the novel coronavirus might mean for the global economy. And so, this morning, for the first time in 11-something years, the Federal Reserve cut rates between meetings. Because, said Chair Jay Powell, they saw a risk to the global economy and chose to act. But, Powell added,
we do recognize that a rate cut will not reduce the rate of infection. It won't fix a broken supply chain. We get that. We don't think we have all the answers.
Okay.
But we do believe that our action will provide a meaningful boost to the economy.
By?
More specifically, it will support accommodative financial conditions and avoid a tightening of financial conditions.
Financial conditions are things like stock indexes and bond yields, the value of the dollar, all of which Powell and the Fed are hoping.
And it will help boost household and business confidence.
With the caveat that it's early yet, not a whole lot of market confidence was boosted today. Details at the usual spot in this program. But there is a slice of this morning's events that are worth a couple of minutes here. Because before the Fed made its announcement, the group of 7 finance ministers and central bankers came out with, honestly, a pretty bland statement. We're keeping an eye on things, in essence, is what they said. So, with that as background, how then did the Fed go about making the decision to cut, and how ought it be read? For that, we've called Daniel Tarullo. He was on the Fed's Board of Governors for 8 years, got there just after that 2008 cut we started with. He teaches now at Harvard Law. Mr. Tarullo, welcome back to the program, sir.
Good to be with you, Kai.
With the caveat, as I said, that you were not there when the Fed made its 2008 cut, could you give me some insight into the mood in the room, or the mood, I suppose, on the conference call, when the Fed makes decisions on the precipice of a crisis?
So I suspect, first off, that a lot of the preliminary discussions were held last week in advance of Chair Powell's statement on Friday. So I would expect that this was a relatively brief meeting wedged between that G7 call and the announcement by the Fed in the late morning. The mood was probably a fairly somber one. And I suspect without knowing that they didn't do anything close to a full go-round with lots of analysis by all the members. And remember, the Reserve Bank presidents would almost all, if not all, have been participating by video conference.
Right, right. Okay, so the personal subjective question, were you surprised when you read about this?
I was a little surprised. I assume that in retrospect that what happened was when they set the G7 call, they figured that they were going to move regardless of what the G7 did. I was more surprised by the outcome of the G7 call, which was about as little as you could have had from such a call.
The markets, sorry to interrupt, the markets this morning did not care for that G7 call at all, right? Because the G7 basically said, yeah, we're watching.
Right, exactly. And expectations are obviously raised. And so I assume that the Fed intended to do what it did regardless of how that call came out, but it probably did take at least a little bit of what positives they were looking for away from the from their own move.
Yeah, so speaking of the positives they were looking for, they did not get any so far anyway out of the markets today. Read the tea leaves for me, though, would you? I mean, clearly, it looks like people are worried that the Fed knows more than the rest of us know.
There does seem to be a little bit of, I'm just reading the market reaction the way you are, Kai, but there does seem to be a little bit of that reaction. I mean, to me, the questions since, in the last couple of weeks, since people have been actively talking about this, have been a couple. One, how much and how does a rate cut at this moment actually help, given the supply chain issues that the chair referred to. And secondly, to the degree that one's ammunition is limited, is it wiser to keep most of it to deal with the actual fallout when the virus has receded and you're fighting a recession? Or is it better to kind of preemptively act now in an effort both to signal the markets and also to perhaps trying to lay some foam on the runway?
Yeah. Last thing, and then I'll let you go. Two words, fiscal policy. There is a whole other apparatus of government that can affect the economy. It's Congress and the White House and taxing and spending. How concerned are you that we haven't seen anything from them yet?
Well, I mean, this is kind of the story of 2020 in America, right? That the political branches seem to have more difficulty responding. And I noticed that Secretary Mnuchin said he's mm-hmm. interested in working with Congress, but it does seem as though everything is moving awfully slowly.
Daniel Tarullo, for 8 years, a little bit more than that, actually, a member of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States, now a professor at the Harvard Law School. Mr. Tarullo, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it, as always.
Thank you, Kai.
As Mr. Tarullo said, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin was on Capitol Hill today talking about the response to the coronavirus. Not on the table, the secretary said, lowering any of the tariffs on Chinese imports. As I said a minute ago, the Fed soothed not the markets today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I touched on fiscal policy a little bit with Daniel Tarullo, what Congress and the White House can do taxing and spending-wise once the Fed has done its thing on interest rates. That's monetary policy. Because powerful as the Fed and rates might be, sometimes the economy just needs more. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore dug a little fiscally deeper.
Ultimately, a virus is not a financial problem. Steve Blitz is chief U.S. economist for T.S. Lombard, and he says if the virus creates a recession or economic slowdown, and let us stress if, it would be the first time since the 1970s oil crisis that such a slowdown had a non-financial cause.
Interest rates in and of themselves are not the reason for the slowdown. Therefore, interest rates in and of itself are not the solution.
So then what? Mark Zandi is chief economist at Moody's Analytics.
Fiscal stimulus is the answer.
Fiscal stimulus, government spending. This is, he says, what got us out of the Great Recession as quickly as we did.
Most straightforward, obvious thing would be a payroll tax holiday. So we all pay payroll taxes. We could not pay them for a while. That would be a cash infusion, particularly to lower middle income households, and they would spend that very quickly.
If the virus were to cause layoffs, food stamps and unemployment insurance would keep people spending and driving the economy. Jay Bryson, acting chief economist with Wells Fargo Securities, says the government might have to get creative.
Maybe we just spend boatloads of money on opening up hospitals if you have to quarantine people. You could subsidize companies for childcare, say. You know, if suddenly we start closing bunches of schools, you know, for a month or two.
Any response like that is going to have to depend on the actual impact of the new coronavirus. Does it pass after a month or two, or does it actually drag down economic growth substantially? Again, Steve Blitz with T.S. Lombard.
In reality, politically, you're not going to get any fiscal response until you start seeing unemployment rise.
Which is another way of saying it's going to take a while, especially in a polarized political environment. It would also cost money. Money that would have to be borrowed. Despite a healthy economy, the government's deficit has ballooned to nearly $1 trillion over the past few years on the back of tax cuts and increased spending. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
About that spending and thus borrowing that Sabri was talking about, this context, the yield on the 10-year Treasury note, a favorite of this program, as you know, and a benchmark of the bond market, The interest rate that bond pays fell below 1% today, 0.94% at the low. That's a record. And it's a reflection of a bit of the fear and unease that's out there. People buying U.S. government bonds, the safest of safe havens, which then causes rates to fall. The root cause of all of this market unrest, of course, is the coronavirus and COVID-19. People are bracing for a wider outbreak, stocking up on food and cleaning supplies, getting ready to hunker down at home and avoid public places. But not everybody has the freedom to do that. In particular, the army of gig workers upon which this economy has come to increasingly rely. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
These days, we think nothing of getting into a stranger's car or hiring someone to pick up a chicken at the grocery store. The gig economy has become enmeshed in our daily lives, says NYU business professor Arun Sundarajan.
Something that people are realizing as they consider the prospect of a more widespread outbreak is the extent to which they rely on immediacy today. If you don't have something, you press a button.
Hiring a car or getting dinner delivered could help people avoid public spaces like buses or restaurants. But behind that push of a button are people, like LA rideshare driver John Knopf.
It's weird seeing more people with like masks get in my car. It feels dystopian.
Gig workers like him could be particularly exposed in an outbreak and often don't have a safety net to fall back on.
The incentive is definitely to drive, not to stay home.
Over the weekend, Uber asked drivers to stay home if they feel sick, but they don't get any paid sick days. In fact, currently, Knopf admits he's been driving with what he thinks could maybe be an eye infection.
Very, very mild. Honestly, I think it's like a sty.
But he can't say for sure because he doesn't want to go to the doctor because he doesn't have any health insurance. And that's pretty common among gig workers since the platforms don't have to provide it.
The current fear over the coronavirus has brought to the fore this lack of a safety net.
William Dow at the UC Berkeley School of Public Health says the research is clear. Workers without paid leave or access to health care are more likely to go to work when sick, increasing the spread of disease. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Macroeconomic phrase of the day today, other than emergency rate cut, I guess, is import substitution. I bring it up because the United Kingdom, as we all know, now out of the European Union, has a somewhat critical need to make new trade deals with the United States, yes, but also with its former partners in the EU. And as the Brexit debate proved divisive, so too is the trade deal negotiation debate inside the UK proving divisive, with some Brits wanting a close trading relationship with the EU, others wanting far more distance. From a factory in the southern county of Kent, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
This is our main processing area where fresh fruit comes in.
Nimisha Raja chose the worst possible time to start this business, making a healthy snack, fruit and vegetable chips. She launched the company in 2016, just before the UK voted to leave the European Union.
We were buying fruit from the EU, France, Italy, Germany, and all the fruit was so much cheaper coming in from the EU when we started.
But after the vote for Brexit, the pound tumbled and her costs skyrocketed.
Apples or beetroot, whatever we were buying, was much more expensive. And we found as time went on that actually it was cheaper to buy in the UK.
She now sources some 80% of her produce here and makes a virtue of it in her advertising. She's no fan of Brexit, but concedes that increased trouble trading with the EU could have an upside.
I think we're all a little bit keener to deal with other British manufacturers and suppliers wherever possible. I think it's absolutely going to be a great thing to be able to buy British produce and British manufactured goods here.
More than 100 miles away in his engineering factory in Birmingham in the British Midlands, Jules Morgan makes equipment for boats and ships. He's also turned to a British supplier and away from a German company that made a critical component for one of his pumps.
We brought it back to the UK and we worked with a particular supplier of a similar product to make us something that suited our needs.
And you're happy with the replacement?
I'm much happier.
Dealing with British suppliers, he says, shortens his supply chain, keeps his costs stable, promotes efficiency, and reduces his carbon footprint. If trade barriers do go up between the UK and the EU, he says, British industry could prosper. Paradoxically, the absence of a free trade agreement with the EU could actually boost British manufacturing.
I think that we are going to see a renaissance in British manufacturing.
But one of the biggest manufacturers in Britain doesn't share that optimism.
The new Nissan Leaf. Simply amazing.
The Japanese car company Nissan denied a report that its UK plant might benefit from the lack of a free trade deal with the EU. Professor David Bailey of Birmingham Business School agrees with Nissan.
A car that's made in the UK might involve 60 or 65% content from Europe. We've got these supply chains that are kind of integrated across Europe. So if you start to put trade barriers in, that makes it difficult for car makers to produce in the UK.
Bailey predicts dire consequences for automaking in the UK if the country fails to strike a trade deal with Brussels.
The hit to output in the UK of a no-trade deal could be of the order of 175,000 units a year. That's over 10%. And then longer term, output could fall by another 500,000. So from the industry's point of view, no trade deal would be catastrophic.
But marine equipment manufacturer Jules Morgan says long and complex supply chains no longer make sense. The disruption caused by the coronavirus has underscored the fragility of that system. A hard Brexit, he says, could help bring more manufacturing back to Britain. In Birmingham, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The computers are older than I am, yes, by quite a bit.
The IRS has some upgrading to do, but first, let's us do the numbers. Yeah. Dow Industrial is off 785 today, 2.9%, closed at 25,917. Did the blue chips. The NASDAQ sagged 268 points, 2.9% there as well, finished at 86.84. The S&P 500 went south 86 points, 2.8%, 3,003 there. Shares of banks dropped hard following the Fed's cut. Bank of America down 5.5%. Morgan Stanley sliced off 4.4%. JP Morgan and Citigroup both down 3.7% today. Home builders did better on the prospect of cheaper mortgages, closely tied to the 10-year, which, as I said a minute ago, was really, really low today. The yield, Lennar, picked up 2.5%. PulteGroup announced 1.5%. D.R. Horton added about 1.3% today. Bond prices, they rose. People buying them. Safe haven and all that. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note down to 1%. That, by the way, is rounding up. You're listening to Marketplace. With Super Tuesday on our minds, we wanted to give you a super deal that you are not going to want to miss. Donate $30 today to get your hands on our brand new Marketplace t-shirt just for super fans like you. Your support is critical to what we do, and right now we need you more than ever. Become a Marketplace investor and cast your vote for the independent journalism that we do. Give today at marketplace.org, and thanks. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Words matter, as we know. And on days like this one, where arguably the near-term future of the global economy rests on a couple of hundred words from the G7 and the Federal Reserve, words written by committee, it should be pointed out, some parsing seems to be in order. So we've gotten Jessica Rett back on the phone. She is Associate Professor of Linguistics at UCLA. Good to have you back on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you read these two statements at our request this morning from the G7 and the Treasury. Also, Jay Powell had a press conference. First of all, to the chairman, he said the situation with the coronavirus is fluid. As a professional linguist, what do you make of that?
Well, it's pretty noncommittal. It just means it's not stagnant. I mean, we all have intuitions about this. It could mean it's getting better. It could mean it's getting worse. But they're not going to sort of show their cards on that.
Seems to me that more than ever, I mean, you know, the Fed's words always get parsed and the G7 and the Treasury in moments like this. It seems that almost more than what they did, it's their mood they're trying to transmit. Yes.
Yeah, there are a lot of calm and reaffirming words. So strong, sustainable growth, safeguard, supporting price stability and economic growth while maintaining the resilience. They could have just said maintaining the status quo, but they're maintaining the resilience of the financial system. They even said at some point, we welcome that the International Monetary Fund is standing ready. You know, these are all just very calming, positive words.
Okay, so with the caveat that you are a professor of linguistics and not of finance or economics, why isn't the market reading it the way you think they meant it?
Well, I mean, I think the implicature of them sending out a statement like this, if you say something like, everybody stay calm, I think the first thing that people think of if they are calm is, oh goodness, why are you telling me to stay calm? I was calm. If I'm calm already, what's the need to send out a statement like that? So that's the only thing I can think of. There's just an implicature there that arises from the perceived need to issue a statement like this at all.
The peril of being a central banker in these times. Jessica Rett is an associate professor of linguistics at UCLA. Professor, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Stay healthy.
Oh, I'm trying. You too. Just because worries of a global recession, however remote at the moment, aren't enough, allow me to point out that tax day is going to be here before we know it. And for as much as we all love to hate, or, well, hate's a strong word, so maybe be not fond of the Internal Revenue Service, the fact is that the people who work there have a critical job to do, and there aren't enough of those people. Rank-and-file staffing at the IRS is down at the same time that Congress is demanding major reforms. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genza reports.
The IRS headquarters is a classic D.C. building. Lots of Greek columns, limestone eagles, marble hallways. But behind all the grandeur, the IRS is depleted. Over the last decade, Congress has sliced the agency's budget, and its workforce has shrunk more than 20%.
It is a pretty bleak picture as far as staffing for the IRS as a whole.
That's acting national taxpayer advocate Bridget Roberts, an internal IRS watchdog. She says the staffing shortage is making it hard for the agency to comply with last year's Taxpayer First Act, which requires the IRS to look at best practices in the private sector to come up with a new customer service strategy by July. It's easy to see why the agency needs a new strategy. Last year, almost 100 million taxpayers called the IRS, but
only 29% of them were actually able to speak to a customer service representative, partially because we just do not have the staff to answer all of those calls that come into us.
Then there are the IRS's computers. Roberts says it can take weeks for the agency's antiquated computer systems to register payments from taxpayers. Roberts, who's 41, tells me parts of those systems are from the 1960s.
The computers are older than I am, yes, by quite a bit.
In fact, it's the oldest computer system in the entire federal government. The upshot, says Mark Mazur, director of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center.
At some point, the technology's not going to work, and we don't know when that will occur, but that would be a very bad situation.
It's already happening. The IRS had to extend the tax filing deadline in 2018 because of a system crash. That Taxpayer First Act requires the IRS to come up with a new plan to update its computers, but that will cost billions. Making matters worse, the IRS is also short on auditors, especially experienced ones who know their way around big companies. Chuck Marr is at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
These are very, very large, complex companies with very large tax departments, outside counsel, and the IRS just does not have the resources to go up against these companies.
And individual taxpayers are about half as likely to get audited as they were 10 years ago, according to Marr, especially wealthy ones. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, something I have to admit crossed my mind during the post-game handshakes at a couple of soccer games I was refereeing this weekend. ESPN reports that the National Basketball Association is suggesting that instead of high fives, maybe players ought to be coronavirus-minded and fist bump instead. Also, and this is the real shame of the thing, actually, the league says players shouldn't take pens, balls, and jerseys to autograph either. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's down 785 today, 2.9%. NASDAQ sagged 268 points. That is also 2.9%. The S&P 500, 86 points to the bad, 2.8%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Samantha Fields, Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, and Erica Phillips. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.